the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's June 2022, and this is episode 293, which is a conversation about sexual identity and the biblical philosophy of gender. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Douglas Groteis, who is professor of philosophy at Denver Seminary and a longtime contributor to the Christian Research Journal. Doug has written an article for our current issue of the Christian Research Journal, which is volume 45, number 1, and his article is called Sexual Identity and the Biblical Philosophy of Gender, and our subscribers can read his article in our new print edition. If you want to subscribe and read his article, go to equip.org. And for the month of June, we are having a very special offer as you help us end our fiscal year in a strong position. You can access this offer at our website, equip.org. And we are offering one subscription for your gift of $30 or more. Normally, that's a retail value of $33.50. Two subscriptions for a gift of $55 or more. Three subscriptions for a gift of $75 or more, and four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more, and you would be able to gift some of those subscriptions to some friends or family who would be interested in our content. In addition, if you are giving us a gift of $100 or more and get those four subscriptions, you also receive two hardcover books. They have some of the best of our articles from our vault, and you get one copy each of the best of the Christian Research Journal, the book What is Truth? And the book Whose Ethics, Whose Morals? So go ahead and get the print edition right to your door. Not only that, you will also be able to, with your subscription, access all of our online exclusive content. And now back to the podcast. Doug, it's good to have you on.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, this topic is a very hot topic because people are just, especially Christians in particular, are wondering how to respond to the whole LGBTQ movement in terms of the issue of gender, because transgender rights and transgender topics are finding itself into the news a lot more, and even Christian parents have had to deal with how to respond to kids who come out transgender, their own kids or their kids' friends. So why don't we, before we get into the topic in depth, I would like you to just kind of give an overview. So can you explain to us what the biblical view of sex and gender is? And I think that's very helpful to the Christian apologists as they think through this topic.
Right, it is, because a lot of people are trying to redefine all that according to very secular, very worldly conceptions. But we go to Genesis for the origin of so many things, the origin of the universe, the origin of the human race, the origin of sex. So there's one God, one human race, and two genders, male and female. And anything beyond that, anything beyond what God set up for man and woman, that is heterosexual marriage, is something that comes from the fall in light of Genesis 3. But what we're seeing now is that people are trying to normalize all manner of things. And it's been progressive because it used to be just let gay people do what they want and don't be judgmental, just tolerate it. And then it was, well, we have to legalize same-sex marriage, just accept that. That's all we want. And now things have gotten even more severe in terms of separating biological sex from gender, and then make gender really arbitrary on whatever the individual wants to make it. But biblically, it is very straightforward and life-giving. We have a good creator who created the world as good. And after he created human beings, he said, it is very good. And he created only two genders. So biblically, sex and gender are the same thing. That is, we are male or female, and we should act in a way, or we should express our sexuality in light of who we are biologically. Now, there is something that has been called intersex, and I use that in my article, but really it's a misnomer. And now I wish that I had not used it, because I had a conversation with Jay Richards about it last week. And he said it's really a misnomer, because human beings are still male or female, but there are these disorders of sex development, or DSDs, that can give ambiguous genitalia and so on. But according to Deborah So, who's not a Christian, she has a book called The End of Gender. I can just read this for a minute. Biological sex is either male or female. Contrary to what is commonly believed, sex is defined not by chromosomes or our genitals or hormonal profiles, but by gametes, which are mature productive cells. There are only two types of gametes, small ones called sperm that are produced by males, and large ones called eggs that are produced by females. There is no intermediate type of gametes between egg and sperm cells. Therefore, sex is binary. People will sometimes appeal to intersex cases, and as I said, that's really a misnomer, and say, well, you see, it's not a binary. It's not male or female. But really, biologically, it still is male or female. And theologically, from Scripture, that is the original design and order of creation. And if people are damaged physically or psychologically from the fall, that doesn't normalize it, or that doesn't make it acceptable, or it's not something we should now celebrate, but it's a condition that has to be worked with, not affirmed.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit more about gender ideology, because I think there are a lot of people in our culture, when they communicate with Christians, they like to say that when you were born biologically, really isn't the meaning of gender. Gender really is determined by certain sociological and cultural differences that we might have. And so it includes a various different range of identities. So what exactly is gender identity? Because we hear that more and more, not just about the fact that people would say gender isn't merely a social construct, but actually how you are thinking about yourself, but that it is more than biological. It includes these sociological elements to it.
Right. Well, you can speak descriptively and normatively. So even within a heterosexual understanding, there are different ways to be a man, different ways to be a woman. But the biblical dichotomy really has to do with sexual ethics. So the only type of sexual intimacy that is allowable biblically is sexual intimacy within marriage between a man and a woman. But certainly from culture to culture, how people are men and how people are women will vary with respect to clothing, with respect to mannerisms, and so on. So certainly there is variability there. There's no question about that. But biblically, we go back to who God made us biologically, so our expression of our sexuality should be consonant with who we are as male or female. Now, what gender ideology says is that your biology is irrelevant to your gender identity. So therefore, a biological man might identify as a woman and may or may not go the trans route and have surgery or take, if they're younger, puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones. Now, there's a huge movement in the last several years, particularly among young women, and I mean women even before puberty in some cases, who have decided that they do not want to be girls, they want to be boys. And there has been a tremendous spike in this. It's called gender dysphoria. It used to be extremely rare, but somehow it's become what you have to call a social contagion. And there's a big internet community, a lot of it on YouTube, supporting these very young girls wanting to make this transition, which from a biblical viewpoint is actually impossible. You can't go from one sex to another, although you can change your body through surgery and through chemicals and so on. But the thing that we really need to focus on here is the whole idea of identity, because in the postmodern world, identity is fungible and negotiable and ultimately arbitrary. So if I want to identify as a female, then you have to call me a female. Or if a female wants to identify as a male, you have to consider their preferred identity, their preferred pronouns, and so on. And it's really what I call a dualistic nihilism. And by dualistic, I mean there is a duality or a dualism between the self and the body. The self is not at all governed or conditioned by the body. So the body you are born in really has no normative force, no say in your identity. Your identity is in the self. And what is the self? The self is not associated with the body. For most of these folks, the self is not under any divine authority or part of a sacred order. So it comes down to what Carl Truman says in his brilliant book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, of something called expressive individualism. It's the free-floating, arbitrarily acting will, not beholden to nature. There's no design in nature. There's no command from the Lord. There's no normative pattern for the family or anything else. It's all up for grabs. And more than that, you go from having to accept these things to having to celebrate them and then having to even participate in them. And I get some of these distinctions from Matt Walsh. So right now is Pride Month, and the Major League Baseball players are being told they have to wear a patch, a rainbow patch. And some of them are saying, no, we won't, because we do not affirm these kind of things. We're not bigoted. We don't hate people who are different than we are. But one fellow said, Jesus doesn't endorse this lifestyle, so I don't want to wear these patches or this particular patch. And this person has just been attacked as vicious and hateful and horrible. And this shows how far down the road we are with this radical distinction between biological sex and then you might call it elective gender. What gender do you choose? I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, I saw an article online that said there were 64 different genders. And that's probably a conservative estimate now because it's been a few years. And you can just keep multiplying the genders in accordance with the limits of your imagination.
So, you know, you're kind of laying out to us this new gender ideology that's, it almost seems like a required belief that our culture would like people to hold, right? So why should Christians be concerned about this ideology? Now, you just mentioned professional baseballs. And also, I think a lot of us just have gotten used to seeing it everywhere. You mentioned that June is Pride Month. And for the whole month, it's not just the people who hold to being queer themselves, but rather that not just the baseball league, but many businesses are promoting this. So I'm getting emails promoting it. I go into my local, you know, for example, Target, and I see all kinds of celebration about this. So should we be concerned about this gender ideology?
Well, definitely, because it is everywhere. It's just hurtling through all the institutions, businesses, state education. It's even getting into the church. Let me give you an example. I was a speaker at a local convention last weekend, the Western Conservative Summit. And there were about 2,000 people there at a very large hotel. And right at the same level as the United States flag was the rainbow flag. It was just flying in all of its colors. And I wrote a card to the manager and I said, I'm really bothered that you would fly that flag at the same level of the United States flag. And I'm sure 99% of the 2,000 people at your hotel for this conference would agree with me. I don't want to just base things on whether I feel offended or not, but I do want to register a complaint because I'm not going to just lie down with the imposition of gender ideology everywhere. I'm going to be part of the loyal opposition. But one area where people need to be extremely careful is state schools, because gender ideology and the exposure of all manner of sexual activities is being presented to very young children. And there was recently a controversy in Florida where the governor, DeSantis, signed a bill, thank God, banning sex education, I think kindergarten through third grade. Well, that's something, you know, that's a start. But the people that are really militant about gender ideology want to get to the children very early. And part of this is that they think we are sexual beings from day one. So they have to make sure that people have a fluid, open idea about gender so they don't get stuck in these rigid, supposedly rigid, religious categories of male and female and sexual restraint and heterosexual monogamy as the norm and the way of human flourishing. So we're seeing this certainly in Hollywood. We're seeing it in the state schools. It's even coming in to some churches. And the way it comes into churches is by an indiscriminate and strange use of the word love. So we say Jesus is all about love. If people love each other and want to be intimate with each other, then why stop that? Isn't Jesus the one who endorses all expressions of love? And no, because there is a fall. Every human self is disordered because of the fall. Our loves are confused. And we tend to make things into idols, including sex. And we tend to be perverted, honestly, to use a term that's not used very often. But our desires can be diverted from the truth and therefore perverted. So we have to be able to say no. I remember Francis Schaeffer, 60 years ago, talking about the culture of the 60s and the counterculture, said, we are a generation that does not know how to say no to anything. Part of being a godly person and following our Creator and Redeemer is to say no to the right things and to follow the pattern of life that is laid out in Scripture. I just see us moving further and further away at increasing speeds from biblical sanity. So you may have seen, Melanie, recently, these drag queens going into state schools to give performances. And a gay nightclub had a special show for children to bring the children in to see these drag queens. Because basically anything goes, and children are now viewed as sexual beings who need to be disciplined into the gender ideology as soon as possible. It's just maddening. I'm kind of rubbing my eyes and wondering, am I really seeing this? But we are, because I think of Proverbs 8:36, where in Proverbs 8, you have the wisdom of God speaking. It's personified. And the last verse says, all who hate me, that is, all who hate the wisdom of God, love death. And I think we see the love of death in our culture, a kind of gender necrophilia.
I want to tell you about a very special promotion that we're having to grow the subscriptions of the Christian Research Journal and get our magazine into more people's hands for Christians to be equipped, as we say in the tagline on our print edition, to be equipped in exercising truth and experiencing life. So we give you all kinds of articles that help you with Christian apologetics and doctrinal discernment, as well as articles that will help you grow in your faith and help you understand your union with Christ even more, including this subject that we're talking about today, about what it means to become older and what the Bible has to say about aging from a biblical perspective. And so here's how you can get a subscription, help us for our fiscal year end, and also to maybe give some subscriptions to friends, your pastor, or family members. And so if you go to this link, equip.org/product/journal offer, that's one word, journal offer, you will go to this landing page that will tell you that you can get a subscription for a gift to the ministry of $30 or more. And normally a subscription, as I mentioned on this podcast, is $33.50. You can get two subscriptions for a gift of $55 or more, three subscriptions for a gift of $75 or more, or four subscriptions for a gift of $100 or more. And you would receive two hardcover books, one copy each from the vault of the Best of the Christian Research Journal. And so we have a book called What is Truth? And another book that's called Whose Ethics, Whose Morals. So for a gift of $100 or more to the Christian Research Institute, you will get four subscriptions and two hardcover books. Plus, all of the subscriptions, as you know, include access to our online exclusive articles that you hear me mention a lot on this podcast. So you would get all the online exclusive articles as well as the print subscription right to your door. So please consider giving a gift to help us for our fiscal year end, as well as spreading out the information for the Christian Research Journal to family and friends, and maybe even church staff members that you attend. It's a really great equipping gift. And so again, the URL is equip.org/product/journal offer. You were just talking about the fact that basically even children are becoming sexualized, and just from very early ages, there is desire, particularly by the LGBTQ+/queer movement, that children would be really understanding that there's this spectrum. So you also mentioned human flourishing, which is a concern of philosophy. So how would this be against human flourishing? I mean, what about specifically this idea of gender ideology does not promote human flourishing?
Yes. Well, I think the modern concept of human flourishing is simply to let the self express itself as widely and broadly and freely as possible. And that's it. And that's a terrible shrinkage of the idea of what a good life is and what a good society is. Even if you go back to the Greeks, like go back to Aristotle, there was this idea of happiness, and happiness meant a life well lived in the community, where each thing is achieving its designed end, this idea of a telos. Now, Aristotle could only take us part of the way, really, towards the good life, because he did not have the scriptures to guide him. But biblically, the world, we know the world is created and designed by a good God, and that we have a nature. God has given us a human nature made in the image and likeness of God, and we know that we are therefore originally very good, but also now very bad because of the fall. So we need direction. And human flourishing is not simply a matter of satisfying or stimulating our nerve endings or having erotic experiences of various kinds and increasingly perverted kinds. It's a matter of disciplining yourself before reality and the God who created you. So human flourishing requires restraint. Restraint is the price of civilization. So we need to direct and channel our desires, our erotic desires and all the rest of them, in the right places. So I think of what Jesus said, if anyone would follow me, he must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. So self-denial is really the path to flourishing, because you say no to what is bad, and you say yes to what is good for yourself, for your family, for your community, and for the world as a whole. But this idea of what philosophers call teleology, or that we were created and designed to have a purpose and to fulfill that purpose, has been shrunk down to this nihilistic, vibrating, energetic, little noisy self. And then the self is really defined by erotic desire. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. So even if 80 or 90% of Americans say they believe in God or a higher power, the issue is, do we understand who God is and how he has designed us and who we are as gendered beings who do not give ourselves our own identity? We want to follow God. And as we follow God and come to Christ for salvation, then he gives us direction. So human flourishing has to do with self-denial, loving God first, loving your neighbor second, loving yourself third, restricting sexual intimacy to marriage, raising children, grandchildren. That's human flourishing. And I find something about the gender ideology really disturbing. And that is, if you're talking about the trans movement, let's say if a young man or a young woman goes trans, well, they have sterilized themselves. They will never have children. And there again, you see the love of death, because sexuality was meant for the union between a man and a woman in a covenanted relationship, and then in most cases, children, procreation. But if you go trans, you're sterile. You will not have any children, and you're actually mutilating yourself. I know that's a strong thing to say, but from a biblical standpoint, we have to say that.
But how would you answer people who would say, specifically in our context, we have listeners from all over the world, but we're Americans, Doug and I are, and there's very much the idea in our society that being American is being able to live in a pluralistic society that does affirm individualism, and that we should be able to, you know, express our individualism and, you know, quote unquote, follow the American dream. So what harm is it really for someone to pursue this and what they would like to pursue of their own selves? Because really, isn't that what part of the tenets of our very society in America, that we would be able to have, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness on an individual level?
There's some truth in that, certainly. But the whole idea of the American system is that our rights are given to us by God. That's in the Declaration. And then we have freedoms, like the freedom of religion, the freedom of speech, and so on. But the founders often said that this kind of a system only works when you have a virtuous people, or at least people who are law-abiding, or at least God-fearing, that kind of thing. And there's also a difference between the legal and the moral. So it may be legal for people to engage in all kinds of sexual activities behind closed doors, but that doesn't mean that it's moral, and it doesn't mean that it doesn't have bad effects on the society as a whole. But then we move into the legal area, such as state schools. So everyone pays their taxes to support compulsory education. Then the issue becomes, what is being taught? And if gender ideology is being taught, that goes against what I believe and you believe, and I think most taxpayers believe. So the law ought to reflect moral realities. I'm not saying the law is going to instantly make a good society, and the law will never regenerate anyone. We know that. But the law does set a context for a civil society. And the American ideal is not unrestrained expressive individualism. It's really the idea of an ordered liberty under God and under law. And what we're seeing with gender ideology is the idea of freedom untethered from any moral order, and then ultimately become self-destructive and destructive of the entire society.
So what exactly are the roots of gender ideology? You've talked about how it's kind of ubiquitous right now, and it seems like it's come across, you know, come all of a sudden, you know, just as kind of central when we're talking about Pride Month everywhere we go. But what actually are the roots of where it came from and how we got to where we are now?
Well, the key thing is distinguishing sex from gender. And I'd point to two people. One was a medical doctor named John Money, who was from New Zealand. And he popularized the idea that nurture is more important than nature. And he was involved in a very sad situation where there were twins, and one of the twins his genitals were damaged by accident through circumcision. And so Dr. Money decided, well, let's just go all the way with this and castrate him and raise him as a girl. Because after all, sex and gender are totally different, and nurture is more powerful than nature. And the way this ended up, very tragically, was that this boy who was raised as a girl never wanted to be a girl, was always out of sync with the girls, wanted to do boy things. And eventually he transitioned back to identifying as a man, but was really never very happy and ended up committing suicide, as did his brother. It's very tragic. And I recommend that folks see this film by Matt Walsh called What is a Woman? Matt is an entertainer in some ways, so it will be funny, but it's also extremely serious. And he tells the story of John Money, who was very influential in distinguishing sex from gender. And then there is, and this guy was really evil. He did some terrible things along the way. He never admitted fault in all of this. And then also, there's a philosopher named Judith Butler, who around 1990 made this distinction. She said that we perform gender. We are not born with a sexual identity. It's rather a performance. And the performance is contingent on your social situation, your individual desires, and so on. So there's no sense of conforming to a moral norm and no sense that you are not your own, that you were created with a certain nature and that nature should be honored and recognized. So I'd point to those two, at least, Dr. John Money and Judith Butler. And now this is just assumed that sex biological identity has nothing to do with gender, and it just has to be recognized that these are two radically different things. And if you think otherwise, you are some kind of religious fanatic who hates people who are different than you are sexually.
You mention in your article that the whole movement in terms of the queer LGBTQ plus movement has also included in some of these issues race, because from a secular point of view, so now we're talking about Christians who talk about, you know, race, but we're talking about people who are not Christians who are saying that one way in which we talk about queer folks is as sexual minorities. So that's been something very big that's gone back many, many decades. It's not contemporary, but what are some of the issues regarding race and the queer cause?
Well, it's all part of critical race theory in some ways, because critical race theory doesn't simply deal with race. It deals with people who have supposedly been oppressed or marginalized. And back in the 1950s and 60s, there was a philosopher named Herbert Marcuse, who was a neo-Marxist thinker. And he said, well, we need to include sexual minorities and those who are not white into the group of the oppressed, not simply view it as the workers, the economically oppressed, those who are alienated from the fruit of their labor. That's classical Marxism. But to really generate a successful movement to overturn society, we need to appeal to all those who have been oppressed by the dominant culture. So he started talking about those in what we would now call the LGBTQ community. So they need to be made discontent, and they need to rise up against the system and join the revolutionary cause. And I should say that I certainly have strong views on sexual ethics as a Christian, but many people who are outside of the heterosexual norm and struggle with their identity, or maybe they don't struggle with it, have been treated very poorly and without being respected, because whatever someone feels sexually or whatever their situation is, every single human being on this planet is made in the image and likeness of God and should be treated with respect and should be loved. But that doesn't mean you affirm everything that they identify with or you agree with their ideology. We still have objective standards to bring to bear. And then when people talk about love is love and Jesus is all about love, indeed, however, you've got to go to 1 Corinthians 13, the great chapter of Paul discussing love. And he says, love does not rejoice in what is wrong. So I can't rejoice in same-sex marriage. I can't rejoice in what is called gender reassignment surgery and so on, because these things really violate the orders of creation that God has laid down for us.
I want to go back to some comments that you made earlier. You talked about having gender identity now part of curriculum, you mentioned. And actually, I want to tell our listeners that Hank Hanegraaff did a short Hank Unplugged podcast on the drag queens that went to a public school for lower school. So not even high school students, but younger children. So this is concerning for Christians who send their kids to public school. And I think it's pretty much not just in certain progressive areas. I know that, you know, I live in the South, and there has been a big movement in the public schools over the years to make sure that gender inclusive types of curriculum are taught all the way down to kindergarten. So what can Christians do about LGBTQ curriculum and emphasis on sexuality, even for, like you mentioned, very young children in, you know, kindergarten, first, second grade, that's being taught specifically in public school? How can they respond to that?
Well, I think the best thing to do, if at all possible, is put your children into private schooling or homeschool them. Because even if the schools are somewhat chastened with the worst of all these things, they're still not going to teach a biblical world and life view. And children should be taught holistically from a biblical perspective on life. It's not just we want to leave out these terrible perversities, but we should have instruction that's based on scripture and the classical disciplines and so on. But beyond that, I think politically it's good to lobby for school choice so the money follows the children. And you could put your children into a classical school, or you could put them into a charter school where they wouldn't be exposed to this kind of thing. But in terms of the fact that we have a gigantic state system of education, it's compulsory, it has to be policed. So if parents have their children in these schools and they can't take them out, then you have to monitor these very carefully and not assume that because you live in a conservative part of the country, that the educational elite that writes the curriculum and in many cases works at your school is going to agree with you. Because we often have this disjunct between the common beliefs of people, which may be more conservative, and those of the elites who come to us through education and politics and media, whose views may be very radical, very much in line with gender ideology. So you really can't assume the best. You have to be critical and monitor what's going on. And I think the best possible option is to be involved in homeschooling or private schooling for your children.
Well, one thing I want to talk to you about, because obviously, you know, we talked about the drag queen situation, is that some people, particularly men more than women, it's been more of kind of a hallmark of the gay community in terms of men, is cross-dressing. And I do want to ask you about this and also tell our listeners that back last year in episode 235, we did an entire episode on cross-dressing, and it's called "Does the Bible Dictate Clothing Styles by Gender, Cross-Dressing and the Gender Binary?" So if anyone wants to go back into the archives, if they're a newer listener, and listen to that episode that we had. But is cross-dressing permitted in the Bible? Because, you know, people say, you know, it's not something new. I mean, all the way back to Shakespearean times, it wasn't women who played women parts, but actors, men who played parts in those Shakespearean plays. So cross-dressing isn't something that's just, okay, drag queens, a more modern type of, you know, phenomenon, but it's gone back, you know, for many centuries.
Right. Well, you know, sin has gone back many centuries too. So I think I would make a distinction between something like a drag queen and a case where a male actor is pretending to be a female or vice versa. Everybody knows that, I believe. So I think the biblical prohibition is against deception. So Deuteronomy 22:5 says that a man should not dress as a woman or a woman as a man. I think that has to do with trying to pretend you're someone you're not. Because if God created you a male, you should act like a male. If God created you a female, you should act like a female. Now, I know there are these cases of what are sometimes called intersex, and we've already discussed that. It'd be better called a disorder of sex development. And those can be difficult to figure out sometimes. But certainly there are a variety of styles of how men dress, how women dress. But I think the key sin, or the key problem that makes it a sin, is where there is intentional deception. Now, I guess with a drag queen, I mean, you know this is a man, but that man is trying as hard as possible to look like a woman. And that simply should not be done. So I think the Bible does speak to that. I'd love to go back to that podcast and listen to it. But, you know, I had not thought about the idea of acting. So there may be justification in acting. Gosh, there was this film a long time ago called The Year of Living Dangerously. And one of the parts was played by a woman pretending to be a man. I don't remember the details, but everybody knew this is a woman pretending to be a man. So does that really violate? And it's a fantasy situation, you know, it's a piece of cinema. Does that violate the biblical view? I'm not entirely sure about that, but I certainly think the drag queens, or, you know, if you have a child who has gender dysphoria and you say, well, go ahead and just dress like a girl if you want to, we'll see how that works out. You know, children need direction. They need instruction. You don't simply let them go with their desires. You try to point them in the right direction. But today, with this gender ideology, where the self is king or queen or queen king or whatever it is, you just let people do what they want, and go in the direction they want to go. Because after all, they have their desires and they have their feelings. But as I said, we need a framework for how to live, and we need direction and instruction to say no to the lower parts of ourself or the dark parts of ourself, and to affirm what is good, and to call out to God, because we can't do this on our own.
So how would you, you know, these are big topics, and how would you encourage maybe the Christian parent or somebody whose friend is, who's grown up in a Christian context, and they're now saying that they're a different gender, or at least they would like to be called a different pronoun. I mean, they're identifying more as, well, I don't know what my gender would be totally, so I want to be known as they. I mean, how should a Christian parent address that, especially if the child's older? I think when kids are little, I mean, you know, I think that they, and they're playing dress up. There's just not, they don't know things as much as, okay, someone's gone through puberty now. They're a teenager, they're 17, they're a junior or senior in high school, 18 years old. And they're coming to their parent, and they've grown up in a Christian context to say, you know, I really feel uncomfortable in my body, and I believe I'm a different gender than my biological assignment.
Well, I've read that about 93% of children that have gender dysphoria resolve to their biological sex by the time they come through puberty. But I think of something Carl Truman said recently in an interview. He said, 100 years ago, if a man went to a medical doctor or counselor and said, I feel imprisoned in a man's body, I'm really a woman, the counselor, the doctor, would say, well, let's work on your mind to get into alignment with your body. And today, the assumption is exactly the opposite. If you're a man and you feel like you need to be a woman, then let's reassign your gender. Right? Or vice versa. So the fall affects us all in different kinds of ways. But the more commonsensical way of dealing with this problem of gender dysphoria, which is something of a social contagion, I think, is to say, well, let's try to work out how to be in the body that God gave us in the right sort of way. So if a woman, let's say a young woman, wants to be a boy, you'd say, well, why? And there can be counseling. You know, a lot of young girls go through struggles, and they're afraid of being a woman. They're afraid of menstruation and all the rest of it. They don't understand it. And they may think that being a woman is a losing proposition in this world. So it may be more of a social contagion or social pressure or fear than any kind of deep discomfort with one's own body. And these things typically resolve once people go through puberty. But my goodness, I mean, what if you let a 15-year-old girl have what they call top surgery, which is a double mastectomy, and then go on puberty blockers and then cross-sex hormones? That girl is never going to be the same again. And there is this phenomenon now of regret over having transitioned. And that's not surprising that something like that would happen. Now, you did, Melanie, also raise another issue of pronoun use. And I gave a talk at a Labrie conference a few months ago about a biblical view of identity. And during the question and answer time, someone asked me about the issue of preferred pronouns. And I had really not thought of that in depth. So I was trying to think on my feet, and I tried to give a decent answer. And then afterwards, some parents said, well, you know, I have an adult son who identifies as a female, and I can't even have a relationship with my child unless I call him a her. So that is just tough. Because on the one level, you don't want to say something that's not true. You don't want to call a female male or a male female. But there's the relationship to consider too, right? Especially with your children. So this is a very difficult situation to try to figure out. But the bottom line is we have to stay true to Scripture and not let the world stuff us into its gender ideology mold.
I do think that would probably have to be, in terms of pronoun use and children who are now, maybe they've deconverted from the Christian faith, that would definitely have to be very nuanced, because if you want to have a relationship with your child and now they're saying they're not a Christian and they totally reject it, I think, you know, you need to keep that under consideration. And then if they come back to Christ, or come, maybe they weren't a Christian, even though they're in a Christian home, and they come to Christ, then all those kinds of things, I think, would end up changing as they get to know who God is and understand what the Bible teaches about sexuality. Well, finally, on a much lighter note than this conversation today, I have a fun rapid-fire question for Doug. And Doug, it's June, so it's graduation month. So what advice would you give now to your 18-year-old self?
Become a Christian. I didn't become a Christian until I was 19. It would have been better if I had become a Christian right after high school.
Well, that's a good answer. Thanks, Doug, for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Well, you're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to episode 293 of the Postmodern Realities podcast with today's guest, Dr. Douglas Grotheis. He has been talking about his new article in our print edition 45, number 1, and his article is called Sexual Identity and the Biblical Philosophy of Gender. If you do not already subscribe to the Christian Research Journal and would like to get our print edition to your door with his article in it, you can help us end our fiscal year strong and get a special offer to our journal by going to our website, equip.org.